folk music cultures are in danger of extinction all over the world. According to Michael Church's new book, Music's Lost and Found, Song Collectors and the Life and Death of Folk Tradition. I met Michael at Cecil Sharp House in London to discuss this uniquely ambitious book, not only telling the story of folk music collectors over the last half millennium, but also charting a story of perpetual decline, he says. As languages and species become extinct, Michael thinks that folk music's faced the same existential dangers, thanks to, well, for reasons that he'll tell us about soon. But in the archives of the English Folk Dance and Song Society at Cecil Sharp House, I found Michael exploring the manuscripts of two of the most famous collectors in the early 20th century in this country, Cecil Sharp himself and Percy Grainger, collecting, writing down and recording English songs from the mouths of singers who would otherwise be lost to time and to history.
Look, Michael, to prove the point about the differences, even within not only specific traditions, but one song and how different Lord Bateman can be in versions notated just a couple of years apart. This is Percy Grainger, Michael. What's he doing, and what does this tell us about his approach to folk song collecting?
Well, Percy Grainger was a champion of the phonograph, and he liked that because it gave him a chance to go back over and over again and note down that the finest points, including little grace notes and including changes of time. I mean, he scores the time differently from bar to bar.
I mean, this is absolutely stunning. So on these two pages you've got for us here, there are one, two, three, four versions of Lord Bateman, right? So the first is sung by Joseph Taylor at Brigg in Lincolnshire on the 28th of July, 1906.
Lord Bateman was that noble lord, a noble lord of some high degree. He shipped himself on board of a ship, some foreign country he would go see.
There's a bar of 5-4 here, then 6-4, question marks about whether a note is in between an A and a B. The detail of this.
Grainger was, in a sense, a scientist. He was concerned with all the minute refinements of a performance, the personal things that each performer brought to it.
On the other side of the table there, you've got Cecil Sharp's version of Lord Bateman.
Yeah.
And where Grainger has got these incredibly detailed two pages here, Sharp reduces it just to three lines.
His is just the bare bones, because he was interested in the archetypal version. He believed that that was what everybody wanted, and that all the rest was just unnecessary fiddle-faddle.
Lord Bateman was
Michael, there's no better place to be talking about music's lost and found than here in the library of Cecil Sharp House, a place that's all about the essence to not only preserve traditions, but keep them alive. What was the impetus for this really worldwide look at folk song collecting, and in particular, the collectors?
Well, it really began with my feeling that there was no book about song collectors, and it was time there was one. And I was commissioned to write a book about song collectors, full stop. But as I wrote the book, I realised that there was a very, very strong theme coming through, which was they were all in a hurry. And they were all in a hurry because they all thought they were catching the last embers of this or that song tradition, and they wanted to document them before they went. And so therefore, the book sort of became, without my intending it, a rather topical Extinction Rebellion kind of thing. This huge musical climate change has been happening, is happening, and in a sense can't be stopped, because the whole essence of folk music depends upon certain conditions, a settled community, a shared religion or a shared political ideology, and also time. It takes centuries for a tradition to root itself, establish itself, and to be sustained. These conditions have to remain. And at present, all around the world, the villages are decanting their citizens into cities, and the villages themselves are dying. When the village dies, so does the village music.
Someone like Alice Fletcher in North America, working with
the Indians
in the 19th century, one of the things that connects most of the folk song collectors in your book is that they are, relatively speaking, outsiders from those communities.
Yeah.
Where are the tensions there for you, Michael? That relationship between the idea of, okay, preserving things out of the art and actually taking them?
No tension at all. I think they were championing the music they found. This is something which Marxist critics like to attack Cecil Sharp for in particular. He's said to have profiteered from the poor people he was recording or he was transcribing, which is, I think, wrong-headed. He did, in fact, make a small profit, but the main thing about it was that he was always, always looking for more beautiful stuff that could be saved from oblivion. That was his aim, that was his goal. And he was an enormous proselytizer.
The collectors may come from different points of view, but how they vary in terms of how much they're really part of the communities that they're writing about. Veronica Doubleday, for example, somebody who absolutely lived those lives as much as possible in Afghanistan.
And she, of course, went undercover and was veiled and became, in effect, an Afghan woman for the time she was there. And that was a necessary part of her research.
Is that a typical strategy?
Yes. I mean, they didn't stand outside the people they were recording. They really tried as far as possible to merge with them, to become one of them, for the purposes of getting them to do their stuff authentically.
To take a contrary view about the idea of the loss that we're experiencing,
yeah.
I mean, there's one way of thinking about the stories that are in your book, Michael, that in a way the collecting is happening to these communities, sort of whether they like it or not, throughout the centuries.
Yeah.
And would there be a way of thinking about today's musical cultures, that there are emerging songs that are being sung right now about political crises, not things that need to be preserved because they're centuries old, but which are part of folk experience?
I think one can look at the migrants coming from North Africa. One can see them bringing their music to us. In fact, there's a new label, a Belgian label called Musique Publique, which is purely designed to record the music brought by refugees. And it's often fusion, because you know, they're all mixed up together in the boats. Their music's meld. So there are interesting things happening, and that is very good. But at the same time, for any kind of folk music to really embed itself does need stability. And the sad thing is that these migrants are anything but in a stable situation. You could do an inventory, a large inventory, of what has been lost. And you'd have to begin with all the songs which in the 19th century were attached to trades. The song was often part of the work. It sort of helped the work go along, and it had the work's rhythm. If the work goes, the song goes. I lived quite a long time. I can remember in the 1940s in Wales, singing games in the playground, songs which we'd sing on buses when we were going on some outing. And it wasn't exciting, it wasn't wonderful, but it was just the air we breathed. It was quite routine that you would have singing going on, and that's all gone. It doesn't happen now. This sounds depressing, and it is, it's very sad, but it's also, it's common sense. It is climate change in music.
Other traditions that you have witnessed at first hand, which are either now not there, or things that are now in danger.
Yes, I mean, I've watched a number of folk traditions which really have been on their last legs. And I think of Albanian polyphony, which is an incredibly complex art form. It takes a lot of training to do it. There are very few Albanians now who do it. And the young Albanians, they all listen to pop.
You do have an example in the book of, I think it's Genoa,
yeah,
of songs that were used for trades associated with port fishing, which are now, yeah, used in Amazon warehouse.
Well, in Genoa, 100 years ago, men humped fish in the port. And now they hump parcels in the Amazon warehouses. In a sense, it's the same activity. So one can't be too depressed about that.
Is there the possibility that while individual cultures may share a lot of the same pop music tracks that, yeah, are shared in common all around the world, mm, they're singing them to themselves, they're singing them in their communities in different ways, making them their own? Isn't that hopeful?
Fairly, moderately. Yes, I mean, they'll sing Yesterday, the Beatles song Yesterday, they'll sing that around the world. They sing Auld Lang Syne in China as a sort of closing thing to an evening's fun.
It's a really important song in Japan,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So songs have a life of their own. So there's no question of humanity's musical instinct being dammed up. It'll always find an outlet. It'll always find some lovely way to do things differently, do things locally. That's for sure.
Michael Church. And one of the key testimonies in his book is the work of the husband and wife team, John Bailey and Veronica Doubleday, in Afghanistan. We spoke to Veronica, whose immersion in the musical cultures of Afghan women from the 1970s onwards has been one of the most important contributions to the preservation and the ongoing performance of repertoires of music whose preciousness the wider world simply wouldn't have known about without her. And as the Taliban cracked down on musical culture in Afghanistan once again, the dangers could not be more acute for the singers and the songs that Veronica Doubleday knows so well.
The situation is really tragic. The people who are in charge have a very hardline attitude towards music. And so the future looks extremely bleak. I do feel very strongly that we have a great responsibility for the world to understand Afghan music.
Are you in touch with friends and colleagues there at all?
Yes, we are in touch, directly or indirectly, and we are aware of the distress that many people feel who are in the world of music, people who are running music schools and who've had to try and destroy all the evidence of the activities of their music schools and all the records and the names of the students and their phone numbers and all this kind of thing. And then we have had calls from musicians saying, please help us to get out of the country. How can we live? This is our living, you know. And that happened before in the first Taliban regime. Musicians just scattered outside the country. The ones who were in Kabul went across the border into Pakistan, and those who were in Herat, which was where we lived in western Afghanistan, went across to Iran. And of course, it was very difficult for them.
Veronica, give us a sense of what the repertoires that you have been particularly involved in as a collector and as an archiver, effectively, but also as a performer. What's the sung repertoire that you have been working on for 30, 40 years?
Well, specifically in the women's repertoire, there are songs to do with the marriage process, which is not only the wedding, but the betrothal and the engagement party and the very sharp change in life for a girl who's become a bride, from living in her father's house to having to adapt to living in her husband's house and being a daughter-in-law. Another category that I'm also very interested in is what women do by way of lullaby singing. And that is, I hope, a genre which will continue. Because it's actually like a work song. So even under Taliban rule, women could argue, if they're not too inhibited, that their voices should be able to be used to lull their children to sleep.
Allah nana Allah goli madar Allah Allah mi go malashi machet konum ki mullashi machet beri sabah kuni kalam ullar baghal giri.
How important is your work? Is that something that feels more urgent now than at any time in your life?
Well, in the 70s, when we lived in Afghanistan, collecting the main body of material which I work with, the musical culture was thriving and healthy. So it wasn't as though we had any sense of working with an endangered species. But of course, now the situation has changed greatly. We have been through decades of concern about the status of music in Afghanistan. This is not really a new situation. We've been there before, really since the Soviet invasion, when there was so much fighting. When I spoke to women in Afghanistan, when I went to Afghanistan in a slightly safer period in the 1990s, they said, oh no, we couldn't think about singing then. Our hearts were broken. You know, you don't want to sing when people are dying and when you've suffered so much.
If you were to sing, what would it be?
Well, I would quite like to offer a taste of this Chard Beatty tradition. It's a poetic form which goes back 1,000 years or more. Really, it's a medium for expressing ideas, poetic ideas and emotion, sadness and lament. So you might get a taste of how people feel. The pain of separation has blackened my days, and it's my fate to cry and weep bitterly. Don't laugh at my beating my breast. These days that you see are the work of God.
جدایی روزگارم را سیاه کرد نصیبم گیری و شور و نوا کرد جان مبوی نخند گل به چاک سینه من همی روزایی که میبینی خدا کرد وی برفتی و نگاه می کردم یاد به حق تو دعا می کردم یاد ندانستم از این روز جدایی نکه جان را فدات می کردم یار وی.
Veronica Doubleday and the music of the women of Afghanistan. And Veronica is one of the collectors in Michael Church's new book, Music's Lost and Found, which is out from Boydell Press on the 15th of October. And the campaign to protect Afghan musicians launched this week. Go online to find out more.